Podcast incoming. Episode 105. The Atomic Age. Part 2. Robot Monster. Robot Monster.
Hello, and welcome to a special secret edition of 50 Years of Shit Robots with Matt Brown. Hello, and Stephen Murray.
Well, hello.
This is part 2. Of our little series, who knows how many episodes it'll be, called The Atomic Age, where we take a look at films that we've already discussed. So it's something of a rehashing of old material. But these are all films that were, I mean, inspired might be the wrong word, but created in the sort of cultural wake of the bombs that went off and were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
These are shadows that were made by these bombs.
They were, absolutely are. So the first one was all about the film The Day the Earth Stood Still. So this is a reposting of episode 19, all about the film Robot Monster from 1953. But with some special, ooh, that's exciting, added content. You've got some extra info that we didn't know at the time, haven't you?
Well, yeah, it keeps popping up. Looney Tunes back in action. There's a big scene at the end when all these monsters from cinema and TV are unleashed and Robot Monster is in there, bobbling about.
It's so weird, isn't it? Because, I mean, Robot Monster from memory was something of a cult classic at the time. It did quite well at the box office, I think, didn't it?
It did, strangely enough, oddly enough, to the surprise of everyone.
Yeah, but it seems so strange that the animators of a 2003 Looney Tunes animated film would want to reference a quite obscure 1953 science fiction film.
Was he obscure by then?
He must have been. I mean, I'd never heard. I mean, admittedly, I'm no expert, but I'd never heard of Robot Monster before embarking on this ludicrous journey that you've strapped me into.
Dragged you down.
This ludicrous path you've dragged me down. So anyway, so you can go and see if you see Looney Tunes back. What is it? Back in Action, it's called.
Looney Tunes Back in Action, Brendan Fraser.
Then you can enjoy seeing Robot Monster in that. I've got a little bit. I was doing a little bit of digging about apocalyptic films, because it's not so much that the story in Robot Monster has got nuclear war at its heart, but it's a post-apocalyptic society, isn't it?
Yes.
Which is why we're including it. And I had a little look at post-apocalyptic films prior to this, or prior to the 1950s, and there are four that are mentioned. Ooh. They are from 1916 called The End of the World.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen that one?
Yeah, with some pretty spectacular, for then, special effects.
Okay.
Tidal waves and buildings coming down, yeah.
And whatnot. There is a film from 1931 called End of the World.
Know of it, but I don't think I've seen it.
In 1933, there's a film called Deluge.
Yes, that's another one. That really great special effects in that one.
I was sort of looking at the plot of that, and it seems so ludicrous. It's about a bloke who's got a family, and he and his family are trying to survive these cataclysmic natural disasters. He gets separated from his family, assumes that they're dead, so falls in love with somebody else, but then like hooks up again with his family, knowing they're not dead, and basically says, "I'm afraid I can't choose between you." So basically becomes like a bigamist.
You obviously haven't watched a lot of films from the 30s and 40s, because that is standard fare.
It's standard practice. So I thought that was fun. I might try and watch Deluge at some point. And the only other pre-1950s post-apocalyptic film, according to Wikipedia, is a film that's very close to the hearts of regular 50 Years of Shit Robots listeners, because it's come up before, a film called Things to Come from 1936.
Yes.
So this is it an H.G. Wells story?
It is.
It says it's based on a book that he wrote in 1933 called The Shape of Things to Come. So essentially this film came up It's come up a couple of times, but most recently it came up in our discussions about 2001, A Space Odyssey. Because when they met, when Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick met, they Arthur C. Clarke basically said, "Right then, Stanley, I want you to watch my favourite. I want you to watch my favourite science fiction film of all time. It's things called Things to Come." And so he made Stanley watch it, and Stanley Kubrick absolutely hated it. And basically then thereafter said, "I will never watch anything that Arthur C. Clarke gives me to watch."
But I can understand why he gave him that one to watch, because it's, for its time, it was pretty spectacular, and it was a fairly decent rendition of the book. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I liked it. And they used artists like Laszlo Mahony-Nagy to create some of the special effects.
But I mean, I feel like I'm well on the side of Kubrick in this, because, I mean, you have given me some absolute shit to watch in the last 2 years. And occasionally you'll say, "Oh, it's quite good." I'll watch it and I'll think, "Oh my God.
What the howler.
What on earth?" So, but there's a nice little coda to this, for this film, with Kubrick, because science fiction historian Gary Westphal has stated, he said, "Things to Come qualifies as the first true masterpiece of science fiction cinema.
What?
And those who complain about its awkward pace and uninvolving characters are not understanding Wells's message." He also considered that, quotes, "The film's episodic structure and grand ambitions make it the greatest ancestor of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey." So basically, he was saying that he thought 2001 was quite derivative of Things to Come. Ironically, the film that Stanley Kubrick had said was a load of old tut.
Back and forth, back and forth.
Anyway. So this introduction to Robot Monster has turned into a bit of a 2001 fest. I just can't shake it. I can't get it out of my system. Anyway, hope you enjoy listening to this reposting of episode 19, Robot Monster, the second film in our Atomic Age season. We'll be back at the end afterwards. This week, we have landed on the film Robot Monster, which is a film from 1953, which has been described as the worst film ever made.
Second
worst. What's the worst film ever made?
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Okay. So I would say from the get-go, I think it is probably the worst film I've ever seen.
It is. But didn't you, at the end of it,
yeah,
didn't you have a little feeling?
Mainly of relief.
Oh no, I had a little stirring.
Did you?
I did.
What?
I don't know why.
Don't know why.
There's something about it that just sort of lingered.
I think that it's the sort of film I can imagine, and there've been a few I think that we've seen that is much better watched with friends.
Yeah, I think we would have had I think we would have just laughed ourselves stupid.
I agree. And I think that it felt a bit of a slog. It's only an hour. It's 1 hour and 1 minute. And it's the longest 1 hour and 1 minute of my life watching
that. I did start fast forwarding a little bit.
Same. So just to start with, the credit that sort of like made me stop immediately and do some Googling was music by Elmer Bernstein.
Yes.
I'd never heard of them before, but I wondered if they were related to Leonard. And so I looked it up and the answer is no. However, Elmer Bernstein went on to get the Oscar in 1967 for the score to Thoroughly Modern Millie. And the other works that he did, not like notable ones, were he did the music for To Kill a Mockingbird, The Great Escape, True Grit, My Left Foot, Airplane, Ghostbusters. So he had an extraordinary career. So, I mean, you sort of think, thank God some good came out of this film.
He was stuck in a period where he was blacklisted because he was of his left-wing politics. And this is going to come up in this film quite a bit.
Is it?
It is, because the Selena Royal, who plays the grandmother, she ended her career in 1951 because she was branded a communist sympathiser.
But this is 1953.
Oh, yeah, it is. So there's some dates here gone wrong.
Well, unless this is the sort of, this is the only thing she could get. This, do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, everyone in the film.
They're all communist sympathisers. This was all that was available to them. It's a very low budget independent film. This, isn't it?
Amazingly, $20,000, but it was the most lucrative movie of the day. It had a box office of more than $1 million on a budget of $20,000.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. I mean, they really did hit pay dirt with this, didn't they?
Well, yeah, but unfortunately, poor Phil Tucker, the director, didn't see any of that. In fact, the producers said, we're not going to let him into the first screening unless he pays.
Oh, my God. This is extraordinary. So, for the very first scene of the film, and this absolutely baffled me. I was so baffled. And it only then made sense when I'd watched the whole film. This beginning bit only made sense once I'd seen the whole film.
Really?
So what happens is that we see a boy and his sister, Johnny and Carla. Johnny's sort of like got a spaceman helmet on, and he's playing all spacey, and Carla wants to play house with him. They're on a family picnic, and they meet two archaeologists. And they have a little chat with the archaeologists. Then we see Johnny and Carla's mum and aunt.
Yes.
And then they all go off and have a picnic. Oh, and then they have a sleep at the picnic, don't they?
Yeah,
they all fall asleep.
Amongst rubble.
Yeah, it's the strangest place to have a picnic. But they have a picnic. He wakes up. He's the only one who's awake. He goes back to the cave where the scientists were, where the archaeologists were. They're not there anymore. There's an electrical storm. He falls over and he's unconscious. And the electrical storm continues. And then I've just got this. The next sequence I've written as just a series of sentences. Okay, so you just imagine that. We've seen the mouth of a cave and a boy has fallen over and is unconscious. And then all of a sudden, lizards, ? What has happened here? Dinosaurs, ? What has happened here? Bubbles, ? What has happened here? And then the boy wakes up, but he's not wearing the same clothes he was wearing before. And then a robot gorilla appears out of the mouth of the cave.
Yes. The robot Roman appears, yeah. And he is literally a gorilla suit from the neck down, and a helmet. It looks like a diving helmet,
yeah,
with a vague face inside it. I just.
And we are 6 minutes into the film at this point, and I didn't know what had happened, didn't know what was going on. And then we get a bit of exposition from the robot gorilla. Who using his high-tech apparatus, which essentially looks like a reel-to-reel tape machine that has been stuck on a sideboard, he contacts his boss, who is called the great one or the great guidance.
The great guidance.
Yeah. Who looks exactly the same as him.
Yeah, that's because it is him.
It's the same person. But so he chats to him on a TV screen. And so then we find out that the Romans have been scouring the planets to see if life is present. They found life on Earth and they wanted to destroy humans with their cosmic ray.
Which comes out of their fingers.
The humans thought the cosmic ray was being perpetrated by other humans. And so humans then waged war with one another and using the H-bomb. They specifically say the detonation, which led to the detonation of the H-bomb. Now, to my mind, that means that they're saying that World War II was the cosmic ray. And it, so it wasn't perpetrated by Hitler and the Nazis, but by space robot gorillas. Is that right? Is that right?
We can go with that because quite frankly, you can go with anything.
You can. So all humans are basically been wiped out by this cosmic ray, apart from 8 humans who, through a series of hilarious coincidences, are immune from the cosmic ray. So all that is fine. I've just about got my head above the water.
Parapet.
I'm not quite drowning. And then all of a sudden, the thing that just, what the hell is going on? And I had to then stop watching it and Google what the plot was. It's where you basically see all of the people that we've seen so far, the scientists, the mum, the aunt, the kids, are all back in the story, but are a family.
Yeah. In some sort of compound with a little electric fancy thing.
That's right. And they have, they're part of the 8 humans who've sort of evaded the cosmic ray. And so you've got a situation where they are now all familiar with each other, having been strangers at the beginning.
Yeah.
And so the story then unfolds that Roman wants to kill them and they don't want to be killed. And that's the sort of, that's what happens.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much weird stuff that happens in this film. Not least, as you say, the love interest between Alice and Roy, where they're basically trying to evade Roman, who's this horrible sort of robot gorilla, and they end up sort of like making out in the desert.
Yeah, they do. They make out in the desert, and then later on they get married, and then they go off on their honeymoon for sex in the rubble. That's the romance novel that's come out of this, Sex in the Rubble.
Where should we go on our honeymoon, darling? Let's go over to the rubble. The rubble is over there. The reason why there's so many weird things happen that make no sense is because you realise at the end that it's a dream.
Oh, wow, you've cut to the chase.
I just had to. It's Johnny the boy who fell over and was unconscious. It's his dream.
It is his dream. Yeah, but there's some very brutal things that happen in it.
Yes.
Roman, to the Clara, the little girl who runs to go and see him to try and stop everything from happening. So, what are you doing alone, girl child? My dad won't let you hurt me, Roman. We'll see. Then he kills her.
Yeah, struck by strangulation.
Strangulation. It just leaves her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we never see her die, do we? He reports back to the great guidance that he's killed her.
Yeah, and he's delighted. Then Johnny has a go.
Yeah.
I think you're just a big bully picking on those smaller than you are. Roman, now I will kill you.
Yeah. And Roy, he strangles Roy.
Strangles Roy and throws him off a cliff.
Yeah. And also, it felt like he was the Roman, the robot gorilla, was a bit of a perv as well, because he was obsessed with Alice, wasn't he? And he only wanted to deal with Alice.
Yeah, and he couldn't cope. His circuitry or whatever's inside that thing couldn't cope with it. Are you going to read out the classic quote?
No, go on, you do it.
Roman, let's see if I can get through this. Roman, I cannot, yet I must. How do you calculate that? At what point on the graph do you must and cannot meet? Yet I must, but I cannot.
Amazing. That's the first time I've heard that, because I must have fast-forwarded through that bit. What's he going on about in that bit?
His feelings for Alice. Is that Alice?
Ah, right.
That's his feelings for Alice. And he does that just while she's tied up next to him.
Yeah. Because it's never really explained that he's a robot, is it? Is it?
Well, in the title of the film, Robot Monster.
Yeah, no, very true. But I mean, he could have just been an alien. An organic thing, which would have maybe made a bit more sense. Because as you say, it's like he's supposed to be a robot, and yet part of the story is him sort of developing these feelings. And in fact, doesn't the great guidance complain that he's got free, he's sort of developing free will, which goes against the Roman?
You sound more human than a Roman.
Yeah. So it's an odd one because, as you say, yeah, what would he be made of? Why has he got the body of a gorilla?
And he's got $20,000. That's all it cost. I had to pull you away from trying to be a bit philosophical there.
Yeah, but I mean the look of the robot gorilla is extraordinary. As you say, it's a gorilla suit, and then the tiniest one of those old fashioned diving bell helmets on the top.
I just wanted to see a goldfish swim around in it. Yeah, every now and yeah. Again.
And you don't know. It's sort of that. It's all blurry inside, isn't it? So you quite sure what it is. What the thing is.
On the poster, it's a skull inside.
And right.
In the movie, it's the actor's face, obviously, but with a bit of gauze over it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it looks, I suppose that bit looks quite unsettling. I mean, the whole thing looks unsettling, to be honest.
And he just walks around.
Yes. Endlessly wandering.
Endlessly walking around.
Yeah. Endless wandering from
There
from
are two Roman. Big stars in this film.
Up there?
Yeah, there are two big stars. One is, is the Billion Bubble Machine, which actually gets a credit.
Does it?
Yeah, the NA Fisher Chemical Products is given prominent credits for the Billion Bubble Machine, which is used to connect with the great, what's his name?
Guidance.
The great Guidance.
Yeah.
And the other star in this film is the location, which is the Bronson Cave.
What's the Bronson Cave?
The Bronson Cave is that location where they are.
Yeah, but why should I know what the Bronson Cave is?
Oh, well, really you shouldn't, but I'll try and zip through just a fraction of the 107 films that were filmed there.
Oh, cool, okay.
The Vampire Bat, The Phantom Empire, Zorro Rides Again, Atom Man versus Superman, Killers from Space, The Searchers, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Cyclops, The Brain from Planet Aros, Night of the Blood Beast, Earth versus the Spiders, Monsters from the Green Hell, The Return of Dracula, Teenagers from Space, They Saved Hitler's Brain, Invasion from the Star Creatures, Batman, original series, that was the Batcave.
Ah, brilliant.
Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, Army of Darkness, Cabin Fever, Tremors 4, to name but a few.
Wow.
So 37 TV shows to date have been filmed there as well. So
amazing.
The Bronson Cave is literally the star of the film.
It's a great cave, actually. Now you've said
it
that.
It's
if you had to draw a cave, that's the sort of thing you draw, wouldn't it? Oh, I like that a lot.
Yeah, I do too.
So, did you know it was a dream?
No, I didn't at all. But that kind of resolution, made it okay because it was actually like a fever dream.
Yeah, it was. The things that I thought were really weird, the fact that there's footage of lizards and dinosaurs.
We kind of should have guessed because Roman was wearing the helmet that. A kind of a simulacrum of the helmet that he was wearing.
Yeah, no, you're right. And because it didn't make any sense. I mean, really, a dream is the only thing that makes any sense of it, isn't it?
Well, there's a similar film to this called Invaders from Mars, which came out, I think, the next year, which is an identical kind of plot.
Is it?
But much, much, much better. Much better.
About halfway through the film, we get more exposition from Roman about why they're there and why they're doing this. So that Roman explains that they have come to Earth as in a sort of preemptive strike. They've realized that humans might one day be a threat to them, and so that they're killing all the humans before humans have a chance to kill the Roman. And I felt in that sort of little exposition that maybe this is like a companion piece to The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, God. This is like your Metal Mickey Thanos Jesus connection.
Well, it's the similar plot, isn't it? I mean,
Plot, yeah.
These two films are 2 years apart, The Day the Earth Stood Still and Robot Monster. And both are have got at their heart this idea that humans are going to not just screw up the Earth, but have the potential to sort of like be hostile in space as well. And I wonder, I mean, again, I suppose you can wonder all sorts of things, but I do wonder whether this is still a sort of reaction to the Second World War.
Oh, yeah, I think definitely it will be. This kind of idea that our technology is going to get us into deep, deep water.
Yeah. And speaking of technology, I thought it was really interesting that, so obviously the Roman, I don't know how to pluralize that. But anyway, this race of gorilla robots, they are superior in tech to us. We know that, right? Because they've wiped us out.
Yeah.
And yet the extent of their technology appears to be almost identical to the limits of our technology.
Yeah.
Which is, I suppose, like it's such an unimaginative design prospect, isn't it? I think from the filmmaker's point of view, that they've got us communicating with the robots via TV screens that have static and take a while to sort of warm up. The robot gorilla has radio antennae on his helmet, so clearly that's the limit of their technology as well as the limit of our technology. And his communication device, honestly, I'm not joking, if you haven't seen this film, but the communication device is in the mouth of the cave, and it is basically like a tape recorder, and it's on a table.
It's a rickety table from a second-hand shop.
It's a rickety, it is. It's exactly it. So I think that is one of my big criticisms of this film is it's the lack of imagination. And I don't think that is down to budget, because there have been some low budget films that have come up with brilliant imaginative ways to get around that sort of stuff.
I agree completely.
So I think that it is a lack of imagination by the filmmakers. So what do we think of the robot gorillas? What do we think of Roman?
It's absolutely the actual robot.
Yeah, let's rate it.
No, we can't do that, can we?
Is it? I mean, we're saying it's shit, right?
It's utterly shit. And yeah. It's zero.
Yeah, I mean, less than. I think, is this
mine?
The
worst? Are we going into mine?
Is this the worst robot we've seen?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, I think it is.
But in popular culture, it appears in the Cars video, you might think. Rocco's Modern Life.
Mm-hmm.
Looney Tunes back in action. An episode of the Cannes Film Festival, which we've mentioned, in the 2010 animated film Megamind, Mystery Science Theater, of course.
Yeah.
Milo Murphy's Law.
And it made $1 million.
It was in 3D, which we've not mentioned.
Yes.
Which cost them $4,500.
Did it?
Dollars for the camera.
So they made it at the time 3D?
Yeah.
They shot it 3D. That makes more sense of that ending. So after you find out that it's a dream, everyone sort of laughs and goes off, exits frame. And the end shot is the mouth of the cave and the Roman coming out of the mouth of the cave and heading straight towards the camera.
Of course, and the little lightning things coming out of...
Yeah, and maybe all of that, the lizards and the dinosaurs and all that, maybe that would have been... That's what they're for. They're just there because they just look great.
Fall off the cliff, they roll towards you,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah. So actually, we're not watching it in the correct way, are we?
No. I think when you went to the pictures to see this, and it was in 3D, and it was particularly kind of good 3D, and also it's considered to be the first science fiction film with stereophonic sound.
Okay.
Which would have made a kind of a difference.
Yeah.
Bernstein's soundtrack is not too bad either.
Yeah, agreed.
It's considered to be his best of his early works. So I think with that, it may have been more tolerable.
Yeah, I think so. And as well, like you're always telling me when I scoff at things, this film is nearly 20 years before the moon landings.
Yeah.
And so... there's no context, really, is there? It's all very well for us 2023ers to sneer at this. But if you'd have been watching it in 1953, then maybe it would have been really jaw-dropping and exciting?
Oh, I think you're pushing it. Yeah. Mildly exciting.
Mildly exciting. Rather than the worst 61 minutes of my life.
And I'm sure an awful lot of people who went to see it were all taking drugs. Or should have been.
Yeah. So that's what we sounded like in February of 2023. Gosh, if only we'd known then what we know now.
Okay, predictor.
Yes, we could have made a fortune in the bookies. So, hope you enjoyed that. Have a great day or week or month or however long it is until we meet again. And until next time, goodbye.
Ta-ta.
End of transmission. Repeat. End of transmission. Go about your business. We robots will not harm you.